Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and every Monday I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. We talk about why they became motivated to act on climate change, what they are doing to help, and their vision for the future. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. For episode 20, my guest is Ronnie Sandoval, board member of the Interstate Renewable Energy Council and also the Gridwise Alliance, and until recently, and when we recorded this conversation, senior director at the Environmental Defense Fund, EDF. All excellent organizations. As senior director of grid modernization, Ronnie managed EDF's national grid modernization efforts to drive investments that increase the efficiency of the electric system and enable the integration of renewables and other emerging sources of energy. Ronnie discusses some of EDF's important work, such as their response to Hurricane Maria's devastation of Puerto Rico in 2017, where nearly 3,000 people lost their lives, as well as the ambitious and groundbreaking New York REV. Shayna, can you explain what NYREV is?
Of course, NYREV. NY is New York, obviously. REV means real electric version. Because of climate change, we want to have good electricity, or real electricity. So there's currently a plan to rebuild the entire state of New York with real electric, which is better electricity. Real electric version, REV.
Well, I guess when you get a writer to figure out what a term means, they come pretty close to figuring it out. Shayna Krivat is my daughter and the author of Tales of Mundane Magic, a collection of short stories that follow two teenage sisters as they explore their modern magical world. They have apps that cast spells, buildings held up by enchantments, and the faithful companionship of, who else, their ghost dog. Nothing too strange happens to Gertie and Bridget, but things might not be as mundane as they appear. The perfect gift for 12 to 16-year-olds and beyond. Tales of Mundane Magic is available wherever books are sold, or find it on shaynacrivat.com. New York REV is the state's exciting and comprehensive strategy to reform the energy vision. Yes, it's an acronym. REV helps consumers make more informed choices, develop new energy products and services, and protect the environment while creating new jobs and economic opportunity throughout the state. And yes, I got that from their website. They want to make energy more affordable for all New Yorkers. By 2050, their target is an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and a target of 70% of New York electricity to come from renewable sources by 2030. Let's go, New York! If you have an alternative entertaining definition of New York REV, please visit my Twitter account at Lee Krivat and retweet the tweet for this episode, episode 20 with Ronnie Sandoval, and retweet your definition with the hashtag LearnAterm. If you make me laugh, I'll include it in the next Climate Champions episode. That's at Lee Krivat, retweet episode 20, hashtag LearnAterm, and make me laugh. From last week's Learn a Term, carbon sequestration, things my mom has said defined it as when carbon-producing companies register to have the excess carbon thrown out to sea in a quest to find a safe place that won't damage the environment. Very clever. And 50's dad says, and this really is a dad joke, he says, carbon sequestration is what happens when you have to play water polo with diamonds, because sea equestration sports are the best. Ronnie previously worked for Con Ed in New York and saw the devastation caused by Hurricane Sandy firsthand. That experience inspired him into a new career where he could make a difference fighting climate change. I'm lucky to know Ronnie. We both serve on the board of the Gridwise Alliance. Take it away, James Henry Bedell. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm here with Ronnie Sandoval, the Senior Director at the Environmental Defense Fund, EDF, the other EDF. I'm really excited to be here in New York City talking to you.
Really excited to be speaking to you.
So with regard to climate change, can you talk about a memorable moment or moments that caused you to feel like you had to do something about climate change?
One of the things I would say is that actually for most of my career, I did not fully understand the extent of the problem and the issue. I think it was something that, especially early on in my career, we heard a lot of messaging around it. You know, initially it was around global warming, and then finally we moved over to climate change. And I think
I should say it, you were Con Ed.
I was at Con Ed.
Early in your career.
So early in my career, yeah. I was at Con Ed. So I've been at Con Ed actually since freshman year of college. So I've been there. I had been there for a very long time, and through my formative years in terms of my professional development. And we were essentially moving along, planning the transmission system, the distribution system, as we had done for decades. I think when the language around climate change moved away from global warming and folks started really digging into the impacts and what that means, that it's not just things are going to be a little bit warmer and you can sort of make jokes, and it didn't carry the same weight as it did before. We started seeing more activity around the development of energy efficiency programs across our industry. We started seeing that it wasn't just a means for making progress on reducing costs for the customers and getting greater utilization on the assets that we already have. There was also this additional element where you're recognizing the progress you can make towards reducing the potential impacts of climate change. And then the seriousness of that began to congeal, and I was able to make the connections. So whenever we would design our energy efficiency programs, be it for demand management or other potential uses, we began to really account for some of these impacts related to climate. And the more that I was able to digest that information in terms of what it means and the power that utilities in particular have in addressing that really drove the interest. So it became more personal, more tangible in terms of what the impacts were and our role in meeting the challenges associated with it.
Was there one thing you can remember that specifically made you think, I have to do something more?
Yeah, so moving beyond sort of the assessments where you quantify the value one might address through energy efficiency programs, ultimately following up on the impacts and reading more about that, you're seeing sort of the destabilization of societies where agriculture is severely impacted. The large disruptions associated with climate change, be it more powerful storms, devastating societies. These are very real impacts that made clear that this wasn't just an inconvenience or a theoretical impact that you're dealing with. People's lives are affected by this just as much as, you know, some of the very local issues that they deal with. You know, if one doesn't have access to, so if, for example, the source of a local economy might be agriculture, and if that is eroded, folks are then forced to migrate, go to other places, or go into other industries. And if there's competition or those avenues aren't available, then you have deep destabilization of those societies. I believe that, you know, our responsibility, if you're able to identify what those are, and you're able to make the connection between our decisions day in and day out on related to the planning of our grid and how we meet our energy needs going forward, if one is able to reflect that and make the connections, you can no longer unsee it, right? At that point, it becomes deeply personal. And I think when I was able to make that connection, that is really when it became sort of a life mission to make progress on this.
Why is this personally important to you?
One project that we're just beginning to launch is around the development of microgrids in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. I think everyone that witnessed the disruption and the devastation that followed the hurricane's landfall on the island was able to see is the human element and the human impact of that. And I think there were other instances where maybe retroactively you'd make the connection, but that is one instance that in particular one is able to make the connection and the role that we can actually play, you know, for taking that on. I would say that when I was in Con Ed and shortly after Hurricane Sandy, so I was involved in the restoration effort as, you know, essentially it was an all hands on deck effort through the service territory. And in essence, the entire Northeast was hit at the same time. So that mutual aid effort that...
You couldn't take advantage of that. There was no one to help.
There was no one to help, exactly.
I know that even from California we sent...
Right. There were folks from Canada. There were folks from, you know, Texas coming up to the Northeast and being able to provide some of that mutual aid to, you know, the territories that were impacted. That, to be very honest, shortly after that, that's when I made my transition into EDF. I spent a little bit of time shortly after that continuing to manage the energy efficiency and demand management programs that allowed us to make an impact on this. After I was made more aware that, you know, if we have large disruptions like this more frequently, or we have these disruptions in places that typically we hadn't seen them, we really have to get ahead of it. So when the opportunity came for me to take a more pronounced role in making an impact beyond my own utility and making progress on how utilities in general plan for the energy needs going forward with a mind towards recognizing the disruptions that could result from continual change in climate, I thought that was a unique opportunity and been very grateful to be able to do that for the last 5 years here.
I think it's a very exciting organization. I worked with them when we developed our smart grid deployment plan at SDG&E back in, I'm going to say, 2010.
Right.
And EDF was kind enough to work with us looking at our deployment plan and helping us value what some of the impact we would make if we did a smart grid.
Right.
So it's very helpful to be able to take some of the softer benefits and put them in more monetary terms.
Right.
And EDF helped us do that.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was it. Well, California has always been at the forefront of, again, energy efficiency. And again, with the deployment of smart meters and being able to maximize the value that you get out of these technologies and not necessarily be limited by some of the operational gains that you get out of these the technologies, I think has really opened the doors for making progress on climate using technology such as that.
Hasn't EDF also made a mapping towards saving lives by reducing the pollution?
Yes. Aside from the energy program, which we've been discussing for some time, there's a health division or a health organization within EDF that looks at the air quality impacts associated with these decisions as well. Going beyond, you know, the climate change impacts, but looking at, you know, some of the more immediate impacts that impact local communities around the air they breathe and, you know, the quality of life issues, including noise, how one may actually help manage that, again, by taking a more proactive planning approach on the front end when it comes to, you know, the decisions around energy that impact us for a very long time.
Like the correlation between how much money you have and how far away you get to live from where a lot of cars are and freeway noise
right.
is very tight.
Exactly.
You've been explaining a little bit to me already, but when you meet somebody that doesn't believe in climate change or has doubts, how do you explain it to them in a way that might convince them?
Right. And to be very honest, there's some folks that no matter what, you're not going to get through to. And
I've met some of those folks.
And you know, that is fine. That's okay. We are all entitled to our opinions, and there's a difference between convincing everyone of your position and finding areas of mutual interest that I think really plays out well in the sort of the regulatory process, the exchange that one has with, let's say, the utility putting forth a plan on how they plan to meet the energy needs. And then you have organizations like EDF that may intervene and may offer a different perspective. And then consumer advocates may come in and look at, for instance, how one may be able to use the opportunities presented in a utility plan to reduce costs for the consumers and ensure that rates are equitable. Even if one disagrees on the extent in which they believe that climate change is as what scientists have reflected and have stated for some time, you can still find areas of overlap and mutual interest when you all agree that increasing the efficiency of the grid, for instance, benefits those customers that want to see rates managed and be kept low. And utilities see an opportunity to perhaps grow into other businesses or look for other revenue streams, as we've seen in New York and in other places where there's more of a concerted effort to explore how one may recognize where we'd like to be, you know, in 10, 20 years, and ensure that our decisions are not being driven by the legacy structures of the past and that we are, in fact, making decisions that are in our best interests.
How do you get to make a difference based on what you do at EDF?
Yeah, so actually for the last 5 years or so, I've been managing our National Grid Modernization Program. So we actually recently released a report titled Grid Modernization, the Foundation for Climate Change Progress. And, you know, it's our belief that with the energy transition that we think needs to happen, we need to have as a foundation a grid that maximizes the efficiency of the grid and is able to seamlessly integrate the emerging sources of energy, including renewable energy, storage technologies, expanding role of distributed energy resources, in a way that maximizes the low-cost solutions that also make progress on climate. If you have a grid that is not able to take into account the dynamic conditions of the grid, you're very limited to how many of those dynamic resources you can assume would safely be integrated and be allowed to play in the grid.
The bigger your grid, the more diversity you have in the type of generation, wind and solar, and also the location can be more diverse. And you can really leverage a lot more.
And again, to your point about that diversity, if you're able to increase the diversity of supply resources, so make them perhaps not as centralized as they've been in the past, that also allows us to make progress on resiliency, right? So if we're able to make progress on resiliency as well, then these large disruptions, when we encounter them, do not have the same impact that they've had in the past. So with the same sort of technologies, and this is why we framed grid modernization as the foundation for climate change progress, by making investments that increase the efficiency of the grid, that means that we're utilizing less resources for the same service that we've been accustomed to. And by maximizing the role of renewables and other forms of energy, we're able to ensure that the least cost solutions have the best chance of becoming part of the supply mix, but also the cleaner resources that impact not just carbon emissions, but air quality impacts, as we've discussed before. We're making progress on those as well. But aside from the mitigation aspect associated with climate change, can our society also address the resiliency needs that, of course, will be, you know, very immediate to large disruptions? So if we're able to address resiliency with the same sort of resources being grid modernization, make it so that when those large disruptions occur, they are either of shorter duration or of a smaller magnitude, then we're making progress in both mitigation and adaptation associated with climate change.
You brought up resiliency, and that is a topic that I haven't talked about very much on this podcast series, but it's super important. It's different.
Absolutely.
It's related to climate change.
Right.
You can do it and use carbon-producing methods of energy generation, but it seems like it's getting so much easier now to do it using carbon-free generation.
You know, resiliency, I think many folks, again, because of the frequency of the disruptions, are paying more attention to how one may be able to plan for resiliency. So there are a number of, especially universities and large institutions, that are looking at, you know, for example, if they're in the floodplain or if they encounter hurricanes or large storms in the past that have resulted in significant rainfall, how to ensure that some critical services, you know, around universities, there have been some universities that have had research wiped out because where they believed they had resiliency, being backup generator for sump pumps or whatever it is, didn't operate because maintenance wasn't conducted, or they underestimated the impact of the rainfall and flooding that may affect their facilities. So I think folks are beginning to plan around that, but I think we need a more concerted effort around cities and states to take account of where are critical facilities, what is the minimum level of service that needs to essentially be addressed in order for us to ultimately be able to recover and come back from a large disruption.
You mentioned before grid modernization allowing more renewables into the system and more diverse renewables.
Right.
It was actually grid modernization, although we called it smart grid back in my day,
right,
that brought me in to understanding the importance of mitigating climate change and how important it was that we modernize our grid to do that.
Right.
Tell me about some of the challenges that you've had.
So the challenges are, for many of these initiatives around how do we modernize the grid or what types of distributed energy resources one might invest in, first is an appreciation of the value that these solutions provide. We've seen a lot of progress made across commissions on creating a venue where stakeholders can come together and talk about the potential benefits associated with the deployment of a technology or a certain application. I think the more that we have those open forums where stakeholders are free to challenge a proposal or at least identify ways in which a proposal may be able to be enhanced by considering, more strategic deployment of certain technologies, ensuring that, for instance, for smart meters, if one has a broad deployment made in one shot rather than this sort of piecemeal approach, one can take advantage of economies of scale. The biggest challenge has been the business case for many of these technologies is there, has been understood for some time. Getting folks together in a room to put aside their cynicism that has been ingrained in our exchanges, especially around utility planning for decades, and develop a sort of thoughtful approach to the deployment of certain technologies like microgrids or smart grid investments, it has been a significant challenge, but I think we're making significant progress on creating those forums and ensuring that the best decisions actually win out and not necessarily allow our past descent to cloud our thoughtful approach going forward.
I had a senior engineer at SDG&E tell me that electric vehicles could never be at the right price point to ever sell any. Like, he laughed at the idea. This is 2008, 2009, that there could be electric vehicles.
Right.
And I think a number of automakers have now completely bought in to the idea they're going electric.
Right.
So the old way of thinking can cloud your judgment.
No, absolutely. And again, I was, part of one of those utilities that at the outset, there was a lot of skepticism, especially around, first the ability of the grid to handle the projected demands.
Oh, I have people tell me impossible.
Impossible, there it goes. I'm trying to temper the sentiment there. But I think that's also a huge opportunity for us to make progress on climate when we make progress on electrifying vehicles, including heavy-duty trucks. In the long term, that impacts, for instance, the noise quality, as we discussed before. If you notice, you walk on the street right now, that's the loudest noise you hear,
and it's super loud.
It makes it hard to take a phone call.
Once again, we're in New York City.
We're in New York City, everyone, for your context. So yeah, we live in a congested area, and the more that we make progress on electrification of vehicles and other end uses, I think, and the sooner that we get started on that, the better position we'll be in order to make progress on climate as, we hope to do. Again, because we've delayed, and I hate to hammer the point, but because we've delayed so long on taking action on climate, I think there's a lot of these impacts that are already baked in and we're going to have to manage. And that's sort of the importance of ensuring that we address resiliency at this stage. But we have to immediately take on a strategic plan on how we transition buses, fleets, and uses as well in order to ensure that we make the biggest progress on reducing our emissions from the transportation sector and other uses as well.
What do you feel are your biggest successes to date?
So I think we've been very successful, and I speak for EDF, we've been very successful in making the case for grid modernization investments across various venues. So we've had a very comprehensive plan of deploying grid modernization investments across different jurisdictions with different sort of structures around them. So whether they were the New York, for instance, with New York REV and making the case for grid modernization, voltage optimization, ensuring that essentially one takes into account the impacts of climate in the decision making of what investments to make in the grid has been a huge success in New York. And in order to ensure that everyone essentially has the opportunity to view what the impacts had been after the investments are made, we've developed metrics around the environmental performance and what you're actually getting out of these investments. So if one is able to, on the front end, design these programs with certain benefits in mind and develop metrics to measure what those benefits ultimately are, one is able to verify that they've realized those benefits. And if for some reason those benefits aren't realized in the way that folks hoped, it allows you the opportunity to course correct and be able to redesign and rethink them. But the goal is to not invest in things just for the sake of making the investments, but ensuring that we get the value that we need. We've had tons of successes, you know, recently.
Which you're most proud of.
So to be very honest, I mean, There's so many, right? and not to sort of toot my own horn, but whenever one goes into a regulatory proceeding, one is able to build a coalition around, you know, a certain strategy and iterate and be able to deploy things. New York REV was a significant success. In New Jersey, there's been a large microgrid that has been currently in the works that would tie critical infrastructures between New York and New Jersey and be able to essentially power the New Jersey transit between New York and New Jersey and allows for critical transportation service, evacuations. We've influenced that process.
That'd be very exciting. That's exciting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Especially, if, again, we saw this, you know, through some of our experiences.
And I should have said Sandy. New York REV is very exciting as well.
New York REV is completely very exciting. And there, I mean, Hawaii, for instance, we've engaged there as well. And they're moving towards a 100% renewable target by, you know, the middle of the century, and being able to make the case for grid modernization and how that is essential to, again, maximizing the role of renewables and ensuring that we're not closing off circuits to distributed energy just because, you know, our system can't manage it.
They did max out.
Yeah. And they're dealing with it,
yes.
Right? To be very honest, and this is a project that is just underway, but again, as I mentioned with, you know, shortly after Hurricane Maria, we're putting together a very comprehensive project to address the resiliency needs of rural communities that have been impacted by Hurricane Maria, you know, the most. So shortly after Hurricane Maria, many of these communities were out for 7 months or longer. And it, you can imagine the logistics and the toll that takes on folks. And we saw, you know, with the reported 3,000 deaths across the island, that it had a very significant human toll. So what we're doing is we're working with a number of partners on not only getting the rules right across the regulatory bodies and ensuring that microgrid systems are encouraged and can be incorporated in long-term planning and the design for meeting critical needs across some of these communities, but we're working through a identification of funding streams for how these communities may be able to access capital to ensure that not only do you take care of the upfront capital costs associated with these microgrid systems, but you take care of the O&M and make this as seamless as process for those communities. So the intent is to expand the available pools of capital beyond philanthropy, beyond sort of government grants that are uncertain at best and to be deployed in the areas where one would like them, but also make use of, if one is able to ensure that private investors or, you know, banks, you know, you can begin with impact capital, for instance. If one can ensure that those sources of capital are able to understand what they're investing in, build some sort of standardization across microgrid projects, and develop a structure in which these communities can continue to operate or have some sort of agreement in which someone helps manage these systems over time, one can make significant progress on the deployment of these systems to work in concert with the grid investments that the utility would be investing in for the grid as a whole. So our intent is to ensure that these communities are not left behind, and we're trying to leverage the sort of the best thinking around putting together a compelling finance project, ensuring that the rules are right for microgrid systems to be deployed. And at the end of this project, we're going to be deploying ourselves microgrids across these communities that make use of the advances we've proposed or implemented across the other two areas, the regulation and the financing. So to be very honest, that, and going back to your question about the yes, human element,
yeah,
this is where it all becomes very real, right? Where you are addressing financing and regulation, not for a white paper. No offense to anyone that writes white papers, but we want to have a plan for how one may implement these systems going
practical
forward.
Practical versus theoretical.
Absolutely. You need both, but definitely you need to marry those two.
Absolutely. You may have described more short-term solutions or more short-term vision, but what is your long-term vision? What does the world look like in 20, 30, 40 years?
So I think I touched on it a little bit with the sort of the dialogue we had around eventually making more progress on the transportation sector, the building sector, for reducing emissions across the entire economy. EDF is looking at all kinds of tools, because time is of the essence, right? So there are some technologies and some applications, again, like heavy-duty trucks, that are still not at the scale where we're seeing passenger vehicle progress when it comes to electrification. But we have to be ready for that, and we have to be able to address, you know, some of the real issues that one may encounter, including, you know, significantly larger loads, charging at, you know, all at the same time.
Yes. And, well, hopefully not all at the same time.
Right. Maybe you can work in some, some diversity.
There should be flexible loads.
There should be, yes. Yeah. But right. But how do we design, you know, structures around that? How do we ensure, if we have a modernized grid, that one is able to maximize efficiencies and be able to enhance that flexibility? But we don't want to forget about the grid. We don't want to forget about the supply mix, because the cleaner the grid is, the more valuable the electrification effort becomes immediately. So if we take a very long time, we electrify everything now, if we take a long time to clean up the grid, we may not necessarily be in a better place. So I think we need to take an approach in which we actually map out across these sectors in the economy how one may be able to make progress on storage, make progress on the adoption of clean energy. And, you know, there are other tools, including carbon capture, right, that we need to look into as well. So what's on the horizon, and how do we ensure that we have a transition that makes sense, that achieves the objectives, and it's not a blind sort of devotion to a particular technology?
What's exciting to me is that it seems like all the streams are moving, and they're all moving pretty well. So if you would have a lot of electric vehicles, as you said, but all energy was produced by coal,
right,
you'd have an issue still, a significant
exactly.
issue. What I'm really excited about is that solar and wind took off first.
Right.
So we're making our grid cleaner. So
right.
as we put more electric vehicles out there, we're actually using cleaner energy. Some people will argue that it's not clean enough, the energy production, so that the EVs don't have the impact they could have. But EVs need a chance to
exactly.
grow and grow. They're still rather small. By the time they are the majority of vehicles out there,
mm-hmm.
we will be large majority green in our energy production. So
mm-hmm.
the paths are actually aligning very well, I think.
I believe they are. And I think the more we see a maturity in the markets as well, right? that it's not sort of this top-down approach for the procurement of resources that doesn't allow, you know, the most efficient use of dollars in terms of deployment of these technologies. When we see the markets working in a very transparent manner that takes into account, for instance, the climate impacts or the cost of delaying action on climate change, right? If you're beginning to account for that, you'll see a more accelerated approach to, you know, the observations you just made about the adoption of solar and wind.
Well, I think it's more apparent now, given all the weather events we've had, or weather-related events, and how much they've cost to recover from. Mm-hmm. You start putting that into the equation, and I think there's no doubt that we have to do something.
Right.
So do you have any questions for me?
What sort of parallels do you see in terms of the approaches that folks have taken on making progress on climate change? And have you identified any gaps? Because as I mentioned before, the value of a stakeholder process in making progress on these investments and getting consensus has been very instrumental. But if you had to put, you know, sort of all these people in the room to solve, you know, a specific gap, right? And this may be a little bit challenging. But for instance, the way that one person approached the problem, let's say your last guest approached the problem, do you see an opportunity for collaboration or coming together on putting together two or more perspectives to really drive something that's transformational as opposed to incremental?
The last thing you said about putting them in a room together to solve the issues, I think people really like their perspective.
Yeah.
So my answer was going to be that people have very similar perspectives because they do. Mm-hmm. What tends to be shared is that we're making a lot of progress, that it's super important, that the data that scientists have been accumulating for so long now mm-hmm. is not nearly as important as the fact that things are starting to happen that are very costly to society mm-hmm. and it's time to do something about it and stop talking about it and convincing those that aren't going to see it. That's very common. I think there's a common element that we all want to just go. It's not time for talk anymore. It's time to make something happen. The sooner the better. That's common. But what is different is people do have very different perspectives. Uh-huh. And sometimes those perspectives, I think, do get in the way of seeing that there are multiple solutions and putting them all together is really how we're going to get there.
Right.
People might say, let's put them all together. But they're really focused on theirs and the one they can see the most clearly.
Right.
And they believe less in the other solutions. From my perspective, I really do see all the solutions. I'm excited about all of them. Mm-hmm. I wish that more people had a broader view.
Yes. I think I've made similar observations. And I think what you just described reflects potentially a role for cities, states, and governments to take more of a leadership role in bringing together various industries, real estate, you know, the utility industry, ensuring that we have a methodical approach to making progress on these issues. There may be a false sense of security or a false sense of progress across even us, for instance, that what we're doing is enough, right? And if we're able to see how all these pieces and efforts are working in concert, and I think, you know, cities and states probably have, and the federal government, have a central role in ensuring that we're all making progress on these issues in the desired way. I think, you know, there'd be more, perhaps more of a willingness for others to take ownership of, or at least better incorporate other approaches or other efforts into the planning of what each institution or each organization is doing. If anyone's out there listening, I think, again, there's a bigger role.
I used to say that I have, hey, six listeners.
Six listeners.
Most of them, my mom and dad and brothers, sisters, but now I actually do have a lot of listeners.
And it wasn't a dig. But if anyone's listening from the city, state, and federal capacity, I think that's a very important role. And you actually have one more listener after today.
So tell me about anything else you want to say that really hasn't come out yet that you think is important?
I think I would urge, especially cities and states, to not wait for a large disruption to happen to you
That's asking a lot.
But I think there are forums, including the Conference of Mayors or maybe the National Governors Association, to highlight the opportunities and the sort of the best practices that cities like Houston have been able to make in making progress on their restoration efforts. So we saw CenterPoint Energy had, even with record rainfall, we saw that their smart grid investments performed admirably, reduced outages from what they otherwise would have been had the these grid investments not been there. But many communities, many independent businesses, universities, hospitals, grocery stores were able to, because of previous hurricanes or storms that they've encountered over the last decade, they were able to take into account the sort of the investments, including, again, shoring up floods and investing in microgrid systems to make progress on that. So I think I would urge everyone to really take more a proactive approach, hopefully learning from others before you learn these lessons yourself.
It's really hard. I think that when it happens is when you get excited, and then memory is short.
Right.
If you don't take action right away, you tend to forget.
Right. But it is important. And I think that is a primary motivator for action on these investments and these strategies that we think would lead to the best outcomes for society going forward.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think I'm all good.
Okay, then I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm going to do that with a rap.
Okay.
So we need agriculture to keep the people fed, and you saw that was a problem when you worked at Con Ed. The hurricanes and stuff, it fed your fears, so you gave up Con Ed after about 10 years. You learned this stuff was kind of a fact, and you wanted to have more of an impact. You know, the carbon generation, it does bring wealth, but it also takes a toll on people's health. The PUC, you called them the ref. Well, the best prosecutor is EDF. We need the grid. We need it, of course, because it delivers more resource. There's a lot of outages like flooding taking out a facility, and that's why we need a lot more resiliency. There's something we all can agree on. The last hurricane was not Maria.
That was incredible. I'm putting that on my wall.
Ronnie's final plea to cities, states, and governments to not wait for a major event to happen to them and to instead be proactive and learn best practices from those that have already responded to disasters is great advice. But from what I've observed, decision-making is usually much easier when it is reactive. Ronnie was very surprised when I started rapping, but hey, I'm an improviser. So if you are in San Diego and want some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv, or both. To confirm specific dates, or if you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell your client-concerned friends about it. EDF has a strong reputation for understanding the multiple sides of an issue. The threat and urgency are real, but they are able to rally broad support from multiple stakeholders by understanding economic impacts and interests as well, at least as a factor in the decision-making. Ronnie's success has come from bringing together stakeholders and finding common ground to help mitigate climate change.